I'm Tavis Smiley. You're listening to KBLA Talk 1580. Our phone number, 1-800-920-1580, 1-800-920-1580. So glad to have you along with us live today. And in this hour, Plagues in the Nation, a fascinating narrative history of America that has never fully been explored. In her new text, Polly Price examines how epidemics, including COVID, have shaped U.S. law and created challenges for disease control. She details what our country learned and frankly failed to learn about how to address the panic, the conflict, and the chaos that are the companions of contagion we now know all too well. She examines what policies failed America again and again and what we must do better next time. Because let's face it, we all know there will be a next time, and we need to close the gaps in our governmental and legal responses. Professor Polly Price, then, in this hour, for the hour, about what happens the next time we confront a worldwide contagion. Professor Price, good to have you on the program. Congrats on the book coming out May 10. Thank you for the time to talk to you in this hour.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Oh, no, delighted to have you. Let me start with this. I said that rather forcefully and rather boldly, without any equivocation or hesitation whatsoever, that there will be a next time. How right am I about that?
I think you are exactly right. The scientists have predicted that this particular, not this particular novel virus, but they've predicted that we would have an influenza epidemic, something they call disease X, a novel virus, for some time. It could be something worse. It could be two pandemics at the same time. But I think, you know, most scientists are in agreement that this is a, we've had periodic visitations of novel viruses, you know, over the past couple of centuries. We've got many very difficult diseases, contagious diseases, still with us, that we are what we were battling before COVID, for example. So I think, yes, this is these are important issues to talk about, whether it's a local outbreak or a worldwide pandemic.
Yeah, let me jump straight away into the issue that we want to spend the majority of our time, I think, talking about in this hour. And I don't want to color the question too much. We've got an hour, so I'll give you a canvas to paint on as you wish. But when you say that epidemics have shaped America in unique and interesting ways, what do you mean by that? How, in fact, have epidemics shaped the country that we live in?
I would say that they've shaped the country we live in because we've become ingrained over a long history of a local response, local control. It's going to be by your local elected public officials. They are in charge. They are responsible. And so what we've seen over and over and over again in U.S. history is protecting boundaries. Once a plague has passed, or we've found a cure, or we have a vaccine, we sort of forget about the day-to-day work of that public health requires. So we have in this country, and this is what has been shaped by our history, we have in this country the more than or nearly 3,000 public health departments, state, city, local, tribal, territorial. Those are the ones that at the end of the day are protecting us from not just novel viruses, but all sorts of contagious diseases, tuberculosis being an important one that I'd like to talk about later on if we have time.
Sure.
But we have that kind of fragmentation. It makes the United States public health system, it's one of the most fragmented and decentralized in the world. So when you compare how countries fared during COVID, looking at numbers, and we see that at least based on sort of mortality and morbidity from COVID, the United States didn't do very well. But you could almost predict that given we're not really responding as a nation. And so in terms of our history, we've always sort of prioritized local control, local response, suspicion of federal intervention, suspicion of neighbors, neighboring states. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what I mean, I think, in terms of shaping it. And, of course, there's sort of more to the story, which is what you can see also in the epidemics that I detail in history is that every single time, poor, marginalized, disfavored groups fare poorly. So we know, of course, that racial disparities today exist in all kinds of health measures. But what we can also see that, obviously, in the past, whether it was immigration status, race, wealth and social status gives you an edge, not just in survival, but also in many other ways. We also see that rich states fare better than poorer ones. And viruses or bacteria cross state lines all the time. So I think that in terms of the challenges that we face, they're not new challenges. They weren't new for COVID. And we could expect, because of this emphasis on state and local control, that there would be conflict. There would be, if elected officials are in charge, at the end of the day, they are in charge of what measures are taken, there will be disagreement about what those measures should be and where the source of information is coming from.
Yeah. The part about that scares me, and when we come forward, again, we got an hour to unpack this, and you said two or three things I want to come right back to, not the least of which is that this indictment that you've offered of state and local control, and I hear you loud and clear on it, and yet we live in a nation that has always prized the notion of states' rights, and we can get political about that if we wanted to. That's not what this hour is about, but that's the way our nation operates. We believe in states' rights, and certainly as a person of color, that has never been that's never been something that we celebrate in communities of color, because we've been so maltreated because of that. But we live in a nation where we believe in states' rights. We believe in a nation where all politics is local. We believe in local control. And yet, I hear your point that that leads to fragmentation, it leads to decentralization, and that in part is what did not work this time around, even as Donald Trump and others were trying to act as if they were leading some sort of national effort to save us from COVID. Lots to talk about in this hour, and I should also mention, since you talked a second ago, Professor Price, about the fact that poor and disenfranchised people always take the brunt of this on this program on Monday. Today's Wednesday. Yes, on Monday, which was the 54th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King, there's a big Poor People's Campaign that's taking place on June 18th in the nation's capital. The issue that King was working on before he was assassinated, Reverend William Barber, MacArthur Genius, is behind that movement, and they released a damning report on Monday of this week. In concert with great economists like Joseph Stiglitz and Jeffrey Sachs, a damning report came out on Monday that laid out in detail the ways in which poor people took it on the chin during the pandemic. And the numbers are just arresting for how many poor people were just ignored, and how many of them died. I mean, the disproportionate number of people impacted by this, poor people I'm talking about now, during this pandemic was, again, I saw the data on Monday, it almost brought tears to my eyes. And so you're right about everything you said so far, and I know you got a lot more to talk about in this hour, and I'm going to tee you up and let you do what you do. Professor Polly Price is our guest in this hour. The book is called Plagues in the Nation: How Epidemics Shaped America. We're talking about what we do better the next time around. We'll continue our conversation when we come forward on KBLA Talk 1580.
We've got a lot to talk about.
Good thing we've got 3 hours.
More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward. Interrogating your assumptions
and expanding your inventory of ideas.
Let's get back to Tavis Smiley on KBLA Talk 1580.
Our guest in this hour is Professor Polly Price. We are honored to have her on because everybody is waiting for this book to drop. It is expected. And people are waiting to see what her takeaways are about what we have endured the last couple of years and how these epidemics have shaped our nation. The book doesn't come out until May 10th, but she's so kind to us that she came on in advance. The book is called Plagues in the Nation: How Epidemics Shaped America. It is a narrative history of America through these major outbreaks. And the book, the text examines how epidemics, including COVID, have shaped U.S. law and have created challenges for disease control, challenges that we were all witness to over the last couple of years during this outbreak of COVID-19. So, Professor Price, you said a few things already I want to get you to unpack for me, and I'm glad we got some time to do this. Let me start with this. I mentioned a moment ago, following your lead, that we are a nation that believes in states' rights. We are a nation that believes in local control. I hear and heard your indictment of it. I've got my own indictment of it. You got 50 different states, 50 different ways of doing things, and that's not including all the municipalities in those states that have their own different ways of doing things. And it seems to me that's one of the things that we have to adjust to address between now and the next time and figure out a way to do better. That's my assessment, but you're the expert. Tell me how you read that particular issue and whether or not we can improve upon it for the next time.
Well, I want to be clear that there are so many excellent attributes of having such a decentralized system like we do. Local conditions require a local response. And so if you think back to the 1918 flu, for example, that hit in three waves over 2 years, and it would roll from the East Coast to the West Coast and back. And it was never really present everywhere at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So in any event, you know, you've got the geography of the United States. You've got Hawaii needs to make its own rules, right, based on geography. There are many good things. I'm not against state and local control.
Sure.
But it's helpful to identify what are the problems that can arise from that. And to be clear, the federal role was terribly important. I see it as nothing short of a miracle that the vaccine was out as soon as it was. I mean, I know it's science, right,
mm-hmm.
and money.
Sure.
But, you know, that's the federal role, or that was the most important federal role initially. And then also supporting states, this problem again about rich states faring better than poor states, that showed up immediately when there was a scramble for limited PPE, personal protective equipment, for nursing homes, for hospitals, for, you know, private providers. States were essentially bidding against each other. Now, some states, starting in the Northeast, would sort of pool together and form sort of purchasing groups. But what happened with all of that competition is it drives the prices up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one place you could have had a greater federal role. But just a couple of examples, if I could, about how these jurisdictional lines create problems. And I actually want to go back to right before COVID. So state and local health departments are in charge of keeping hepatitis A contained. And hepatitis A is a viral disease. It's really almost more it's more prevalent in the third world. But before COVID hit, there was an outbreak that started on the West Coast, 2018, and it spread relentlessly from local outbreak and local outbreak towards the East Coast. So in less than 2 years, there were nearly 40,000 acute cases from that strain, and 37,000 people hospitalized, 376 died. This spread from city to city, and they could trace the exact strain. So the failure to control it in one city, and it's primarily a phenomenon associated with homelessness, the failure to contain it meant that it spread and spread and spread throughout the U.S. Okay, so once, if any local jurisdiction doesn't do its job in containing an outbreak, that obviously affects their neighbor. So their neighboring state may be paying lots of money for public health protection and control, and that can all be undermined by the next state over. Second example, and this is from Atlanta. Tuberculosis. There was a tuberculosis outbreak in Atlanta homeless shelter 6 or 8 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and it was a drug-resistant version of tuberculosis, which is very bad. There were 8 to 10 deaths, I think, before it was over. But the city of Atlanta's failure to contain it within that homeless shelter, CDC was able to trace that strain to 10 other states and still counting, and deaths in those states. Some of the folks I talked to even speculated, like, hey, you know, they're imposing costs on us because you didn't contain your problem. But tuberculosis is a local health department responsibility. They identify the cases. They provide the treatment. If treatment is interrupted, that's where drug resistance comes into play. And in any event, it's those were the issues we were all working on before COVID. And the state line, jurisdictional city-county lines were already causing problems in keeping track of patients that were mobile.
Mm-hmm. What is to be done about rich states versus poor states? I mean, it is what it is. Some states have more resources than other states do. And again, I'm trying to make sure we stay focused on not just the way these plagues have impacted, these epidemics have shaped the nation, but how we do better next time around. What is to be done, to your mind, since you raised it, about, you know, the inability of poor states to compete with rich states when we have an outbreak like COVID?
Well, I think, first of all, we had a strategic stockpile of that turned out to be inadequate. But in theory, what that would have done, if you had sufficient PPE, the federal government could be in charge in distributing it in some kind of fair formula basis. And what eventually happened with that PPE competition I was telling you about, when there was the scarcity and states were essentially bidding against each other, mm-hmm. what eventually happened is invocation of the, under President Biden, the Defense Production Act, which allows basically the federal government has enormous contracting authority and can prevent that kind of bidding up the prices, but also find some kind of path towards fair distribution. The problem arises also with limited access to treatment. Okay, so if Texas has more need, but so does Michigan, and there are limited supplies, should those states be negotiating directly with the drug companies, or should they be negotiating with the federal government, with HHS, to try to find some kind of fair way to distribute limited supplies? So I think it's when you have sort of scarcity of supplies, treatments, vaccines, whatever it is, that's where the federal government is best. And that's what we should probably move more quickly on next time.
Yep. So it's clear to me from going through your book that law and government have affected the outcomes of these various epidemics throughout history. But the flip side of that is how these pandemics have reshaped government as we know it. Can you take the latter question for me and expound on that for me?
That's a great question. I start from the premise of looking at how some other types of government dealt with the COVID pandemic, much more authoritarian, rules that were sort of mandatory, quarantines and shutdowns, compared to, say, democratic governments, whether they're federalist systems or not, where you're essentially, at the end of the day, you're voting on what level of protection you want to have. You need effective governance. You need trust in scientific institutions. But it's the governance function of who is in charge, who can make the decisions, do the people generally agree with those, are they willing to abide by what the mayor says or the governor says, and because you can't really, in a pandemic situation like COVID, you can't have police officers out enforcing everything. It's just a poor use of resources. So you hope to get, through effective governance, leaders who get people to come along with them that can make the convincing case of this is what we need to do, this is why we need to do it. That's made much harder when you have, when you're still learning what COVID-19 is all about. Mm-hmm. And, in the U.S., first we watched Wuhan, China be completely locked down and Americans evacuated. Then we see what happens in Italy with the hospitals overrun, and we see Great Britain, and it's just marching towards us. So in any event, I think I got away from your original question, if you could point me back in the right direction.
No, you didn't. You addressed it. I was raising this question about, well, let me pivot this way, because you addressed that. I want to pivot ever so slightly, because as you were talking, you know, you underscore this issue of not just rich states versus poor states, but rich people versus poor people. And I want to get your take on, again, the next time around, because, again, there will be another time, whether or not there are things this time around that we missed, things we can do better about how to keep this these epidemics, these pandemics, as it were, from so disproportionately impacting and affecting poor people? Or are you just not hopeful about that?
I am hopeful about it. I think what one of the things you've got to do is make it possible for people to comply. So if you want social distancing and you want to limit, close non-essential businesses, you've got to be able to replace the income. I mean, people shouldn't be coming to work sick because they have to have money. But you've got to be able to get that paycheck protection plan out earlier. If you ask somebody to quarantine for 2 weeks, you know, because they've been exposed to COVID, you got to make sure they have a place to live. You've got to make sure they have food. You've got to be able to provide all of these things. And I think that's where we were least ready, was making big asks of the public in terms of what we needed to do, especially early in the pandemic, to try to prevent complete collapse of our hospital system. What we were asking people to do hit the poor the hardest. And at the same time, we did not know that these racial disparities should have, but that racial disparities in deaths were happening. And one reason for that is states are all over the place in what medical providers are required to report, what kinds of data the health department gets. So in many states, for the first full year of the pandemic, there was no breakdown by race or gender. And then when there finally was a breakdown by race or gender, it's horrific when you see some of the, and poverty as well. I mean, when you see what was really happening. So one of the additional steps that states might take mm-hmm. when they're thinking about legislating for the future is mandating some kind of reporting where they ask that question, because if you don't know what the problem is, you can't really address it mm-hmm. until it's too late. So that was important for HIV/AIDS, important for other issues as well. But that would be one thing that state legislatures can certainly do, is try to prepare themselves either administratively, strengthening in the public health department, so that they have better eyes on the ground and they know locally what is happening and they can take action.
Yep. One of the things I think that people are going to appreciate when this book comes out on May 10th, and the book is called Plagues in the Nation, How Epidemics Shaped America, is the following, which I want to get to right after news and traffic here in about 40 seconds. You detail, quite nicely, what we have failed to learn by these epidemics. This ain't the first pandemic we've had in this country, and obviously it's not the first epidemic that this country has endured. But we continue to fail to learn these lessons about how to address the panic and the conflict and the chaos, as I mentioned earlier, that are the companions of contagion. And I'm curious as to what Professor Price has to share with us about what we haven't learned. Again, this ain't our first rodeo, right? This one shut the country down. We were all troubled by it in a variety of ways, and a million people practically have died from this. And yet there are lessons that we have yet to learn about how to address moments of conflict and chaos like this, when we have to counter a contagion. So I want to go right to that, which we'll do after news and traffic here on KBLA Talk 1580.
The station you turn to when you had it up to gear with cultural incompetence. KBLA Talk 1580. Less BS per broadcast. Fewer microaggressions per megawatt. KBLA Talk 1580.
Dropping on May 10th, the new book, Plagues in the Nation, The Epidemics That Shaped America. How epidemics shaped America. People are looking forward to the text because it's a polemic on what these epidemics and pandemics ought to have taught us, what we are still not learning, as it were, and how we can do better the next time, vis-a-vis how these pandemics end up shaping the nation in which we live. And so I want to talk now, Professor Price, if we can, and give you some space to unpack what it is that with all these epidemics that we have successfully processed our way through, we continue to fail to learn about how to address the panic and the conflict and the chaos that we now know full well are companions of contagion. Your thoughts?
I think that based on the most shameful thing of all to me was the divide in American society, where we have a great wealthy nation, scientific expertise is envied by the world. We failed our most vulnerable citizens, and it was not just the elderly, but as we were talking about earlier, the poor, the marginalized, disfavored groups. Mm-hmm. I think what we have not learned is the federal government can help more there. And let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. I think we're in the process of learning this. So the eviction moratorium that was started under President Trump and then continued was a nationwide temporary moratorium to prevent evictions so that we wouldn't create more homelessness because of the economic disruption from COVID. So Congress accompanied that with a big bunch of money that they distributed to the states on a more or less per capita basis. Some states distributed that money promptly and efficiently to tenants, to renters. Some states still haven't distributed much, if any, of it. And so we see this sort of very uneven ability. It's either the ability of the states or do they want to help. The federal government can help more where states are either unwilling or unable to prevent these kinds of racially disparate impacts, poverty, and then especially, as I said earlier, the shamefulness of the death rate in our nursing homes. So that's one area. The second is, I think, states, and they are in the process of doing this too, their legislatures, they have to clarify who is in charge even within their own state. A lot of the litigation we were seeing would be one branch of a state government suing the other, the legislature suing the governor, for example. And then we also saw governors suing cities like Florida, Georgia, other places, cities suing to try to have their own rules. We've got to clarify that, because I think what surprised lots of observers most about sort of law and governance is that for the first time in U.S. history, all 50 state governors declared states of emergency, and then most of the COVID measures, whether they had COVID measures or didn't have COVID measures, they were all by executive order. So after that goes on for nearly a year and a half, almost 2 years, you can understand that the legislature says, like, well, wait a minute. We want to say in what the rules are. That's normally how we have law in this country, right? The legislature enacts the laws, the governor enforces them or carries them out. So there's lots of lawsuits, Wisconsin, Kansas, others, when you had divided government where the legislature disagreed with steps the governor was taking. On the governor's side, they say somebody needs to be a decision maker. We need to be able to do things like, you know, waive normal state contracting rules and so forth. So I think if we could get that better positioned going forward, we wouldn't have quite as much conflict and disruption at the state level. But we also saw it even with cities. So an example is, again, City of Atlanta. I live in Atlanta. CDC is just up the street from Emory University, where I teach. The governor sued the mayor of Atlanta because the mayor had had a face mask ordinance. Mm-hmm. Mandatory face mask in stores. The governor sued to stop that. His claim was that because I have declared a state of emergency, I can make statewide rules for COVID, and face masks is not one of them. That case, it was just bizarre to me that it was that lawsuit consumed so much time. The other bizarre aspect of this was Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, one of the busiest in the world, had no mask requirement anywhere. It did only because, and it did for a short time in the first year, because the mayor, it falls within the city of Atlanta. So briefly, there was a face mask requirement. Other cities, municipal governments in Georgia, larger cities, also wanted to be able to make rules like that. They sued. And formed the Municipal Association in Georgia, put in a sort of very strong brief that said, look, there's a long tradition of local government rule, and this is turning it on its head. to say that we can't take these steps. So I think those two issues states have got to clarify. They're in the process of doing that. There's lots of legislation, legislative proposals out there, some good, some terrible, in my opinion. But I also think that there needs to be, we need to learn from this, that often in a pandemic emergency, it's unclear who's in charge, and we need to know. We need to know that at the state level and at the local level.
Speaking of who's in charge, you mentioned the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and they are, as you mentioned, just up the street from you. You teach at Emory University, and CDC, of course, headquartered in Atlanta. And I want to be sensitive here because I recognize my grandmother, Big Mama, Professor Price, always put it this way: when you know better, you do better. When you know better, you ought to do better. So I want to have some grace and to acknowledge and accept that information comes in at different times. And when that information comes in, there's a duty, a responsibility to share that with fellow citizens. And yet I want to balance that with a responsibility that CDC has to put out information that is accurate, that is timely, and that doesn't change like the wind blowing in a different direction, you know, any hour of the day. And I raise that only because I've talked to so many fellow citizens, and I've had them called into this program, into this station, who to this day still have not gotten the vaccination and won't get it. And they point to CDC changing its rules and regulations, changing its advisories so often, you know, like we change underwear, right? They're always changing advisories. And everyday people don't trust an organization that's supposed to be in charge, that's supposed to be giving us the data that we need, if they're changing, again, their advisories day in and day out. So that's a long way of saying, it's a preface, although not short, it's a long way of getting to this particular this simple question, which is, how do you think the CDC did this time around, and how can they do better the next time?
I think it's a mixed result, and the CDC, I've heard CDC folks talk about it this way as well, which is just that there were missteps. Inevitably, there are going to be missteps, but the first one about face masks, where the Secretary of HHS tweets, the Surgeon General tweets, that we people should stop buying face masks, not hoard them, mm-hmm. not make a run on them, the kind that actual hospital workers need it. Okay, and then not long after that, there is, everybody, you should make your own cloth face mask. We need face masks. So there is that sort of about face that is exactly, I think, what you're talking about. And it's not just limited to that. Mm-hmm. There were testing problems early on, getting enough tests out to people so that you even know who had been exposed to COVID or had COVID. There are problems with that. So I think there is sort of two things that need to be done going forward. One is some way to kind of restore what we would like to think of as scientifically institution insulated from politics,
mm-hmm.
Better than it was. So that you regain trust in an institution, I think, the less that it looks like it changes with the political wind.
Yeah.
And so there was some of that that seemed to creep into what CDC, you know, had to deal with. But then the second thing is just I think the role of CDC in the U.S. is really, it's very interesting. They're advisory only. They can't actually go into a state and help them unless the state invites them.
Mm-hmm.
They do a terrific job. If it weren't for CDC, for example, I think our tuberculosis programs in the United States, preventing the kind of drug-resistant tuberculosis that's rampant in other parts of the world, I think that would be less easy to control, because there's a division of TB control. There's a division, you know, that supports state and local health departments for HIV, foodborne illnesses, the investigations that CDC does. They do so many things. They have 10,000 employees. I think there's got to be sort of a you know, so I think a top-down reassessment of how can we be better at what we are best at. Yeah. And that we've got to restore the trust, and one way might be just if we can find a way to insulate them more, I think, from what looks like the political winds.
I'm glad you said that, because when we come forward here, I want to talk specifically about that. So you are not just an expert in your field, you're also a mind reader, apparently. So I want to talk about politics, and I don't mean to make you political, but it's abundantly clear to every one of us who lives in this country that politics, I was going to say crept their way into, no, they didn't creep. Politics walked up boldly and arrogantly into this process. So there's nothing as combustible, I have learned, than the combination of pandemic and politics. And I want to talk about how you think politics got in the way, have gotten in the way, as we've tried to navigate historically through epidemics and pandemics. Most recently, of course, COVID-19. We'll talk about the politics when we come forward with Professor Polly Price. A lot of P's there. I don't say that too fast. You're listening to KBLA Talk 1580.
Be sure to like and follow Tavis Smiley at The Real Tavis Smiley.
And get Twitter updates
at Tavis Smiley. The conversation continues when we come forward. Forward.
Did you
know the righteous rage? And don't be afraid to say what you see. We're KBLA Talk 1580.
The new text is called Plagues in the Nation, How Epidemics Shaped America. It could very well have been called Politics in the Nation, How Epidemics Shaped America. There's no running away from this, Professor Price, that politics got all up in the mix during this pandemic. Again, I don't want to color the question too much, but your thoughts about what you were seeing as a healthcare professional, a professor, as you sat back and watched the way politics just got all up in the mix, how did you process it?
I think what surprised me the most was various measures that are sort of standard for taking against spread of contagious disease, especially airborne, how those became identified with specific political parties. Mm-hmm. Talk about face masks in particular, but also to some extent vaccines and certainly whatever social distancing measures there were. It's not that we've never done this before in a country. We've had, the 1918 Great Influenza was certainly one instance in which there were controversies about face masks, and there was a hope for a vaccine, but that never materialized. And these were a lot of local decisions, you know, about whether to close the schools and so forth. But I never saw that, even though people might get very upset about these measures, I never saw it identified with a particular political party. And that's true for other epidemics as well that presented different issues. When the polio vaccine came out, for example, there was a way to identify political parties, at least on the issue of vaccine distribution. As a general rule, the Republicans thought that vaccine distribution should just be handled in the private market, and that's largely what happened. So again, states and cities that had a lot of money could buy lots of vaccines to give to school kids and so forth. They thought that it should not be distributed by the federal government, or that the federal government should have no role. So you couldn't see that. That's kind of a Republican small government versus what's the best way to, distribute it. And I was fascinated to learn about the lines and near riots when the polio vaccine became available, about parents trying to get their children there. And that should have been sort of a wake up call about, we need to think about how we're going to distribute limited resources when there's great demand for it. But of course, polio was primarily a very scary thing for people's children, and I think that shaped the view too. So I guess that surprised me to see that there seemed to be a political party view about measures that other countries were taking as, you know, sort of scientifically based, and not political. They may not like them, but they're not a political party.
Well, that's the problem with our country. It's the challenge we face right now, that everything has become so politicized that even in a moment like a pandemic, people are making choices and making outlandish and outrageous statements based on their political views. And when we come forward in our remaining moments with you, I want to come back to this point that you've just made. Again, you've led me so beautifully in this hour, and I appreciate it. It makes my job a little easier. So I want to close with this. And this is my greatest fear. You've written this powerful text, Plagues in the Nation, How Epidemics Shaped America, coming out May 10. We should all get it. Certainly our elected officials should get it to see what we ought to be learning from these epidemics and how they are shaping the nation and more broadly the world in which we live. But the thing that scares me the most is that we have an increasing number of fellow citizens who just don't trust the science. They don't trust. They don't believe. They don't want to be guided by the science. And so you could write these brilliant texts, once or twice a year if you wanted to. And yet for all the data that's out there, if you have an electorate, if you have a citizenry that doesn't believe increasingly in the science, what's it all mean? We'll offer that question to Professor Polly Price and get her take on it in our remaining moments with her when we come forward on KBLA Talk 1580.
You have the right to remain silent, but don't. Let them hear you on KBLA Talk 1580. Let's unpack a little bit more with Tavis Smiley. The conversation continues right now.
Professor Price, I got about 2 minutes left in this conversation. I end on a note that might not be so positive, but what say you about how we navigate better the next time around as increasingly certain segments of our society just don't trust the science?
I don't know how you change that, but I do think that state governors, if we are going to keep the system, which we've had for many, many, many decades, of it's a local responsibility for containing epidemics and helping your population. If we keep that, if the governors could make their director of public health an important position, get them on the stage, get them talking about the science in a way that people trust, I think that can help change minds at the state and local level. You may remember back in HIV/AIDS, C. Everett Koop was the Surgeon General, mm-hmm. the nation's doctor, probably the best-known Surgeon General ever. Out front, he was out front giving information that people needed to know. So, how do you restore trust like that? I think just starting at the state level by strengthening our state and local public health departments and making that position, mm-hmm. essentially the director of HHS for each state, make that position front and center, important, get quality people in there, and let the public see them.
I got 30 seconds right quick here. Anything about these epidemics that we've endured and how they shaped America, namely this pandemic around COVID-19, any of the damage you think that's been done irreparable, anything that we can't fix at this point?
Oh, there's nothing that's irreparable. I'm eternal optimist about the damage. But I do think what's very difficult to overcome is what we saw in past epidemics is how easy it is for states and cities to turn against each other, the neighbors, because of sort of a NIMBY, not in my backyard, et cetera. That's very easy. That's difficult to overcome, but it's not new with COVID.
Professor of Law and Professor of Global Health at Emory University in Atlanta. Her name is Polly Price. Her book is called Plagues in the Nation, How Epidemics Shaped America. Pleased to have had her on for this hour. Professor Price, all the best to you. Good luck when the book drops on May 10, and thanks for the conversation. We appreciate you.
Thank you so much. Enjoyed it.
Good to have you on. A conversation with Chuck D. After news and traffic on KBLA Talk 1580.
KBLA 1580 Santa Monica.